probably don't know these five names. Kevin Martin, Michael Copps, Jonathan Adelstein, Deborah Taylor Tate, and Robert McDowell. But they are among the five most powerful people in broadcasting in America because they are the five commissioners of the Federal Communications Commission. Yesterday on the show, Aaron Barnhart, our TV guy, and I were talking about the Second Circuit Court of Appeals overturning the FCC's rulings when it came to fleeting profanity over the airwaves, Bono dropping the F-bomb at an awards telecast, Cher and others on a Fox broadcast. The court essentially said that the FCC had overstepped its bounds. We talked about that on yesterday's show, and then last night I read a piece that Commissioner Michael Copps wrote as an op-ed for the New York Times, which he titled "The Price of Free Airwaves." And I've invited him to talk about that and some other FCC-related issues this afternoon here on KMOX. Mike, thanks for your time today.
Thank you for the opportunity to be with you. I appreciate it.
I want to quote from the very first two paragraphs of your op-ed in which you said, quote, "As a member of the Federal Communications Commission, I often hear how fed up Americans are with the news media. Too much, if it bleeds, it leads on the evening news, and not enough real coverage of local issues. Too little high-quality entertainment, and too many people eating bugs. It doesn't have to be this way." What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, I think that we have lost some of the better qualities of our media in the last several years, and that's not all the fault of media. It's largely the fault, significantly the fault of the FCC, too. We have lost a lot in the way of diversity on the airwaves. We've lost a lot of localism. We've been through a tremendous wave of consolidation in the media. Fewer and fewer huge companies owning more and more outlets, a loss of community broadcasters. It affects our entertainment from the standpoint of you get more of this nationalized and homogenized fare and less of real local events. A lot of that nationalized fare is targeted toward a specific demographic, so you get a lot of the kind of programming that many people don't like with regard to too much violence or gratuitous sex or whatever, but you more than that, even you lose something in the way of the breadth of diversity of expression we need to have to keep democracy going in this country. One of the first casualties, I think, of this consolidation has been diminished newsrooms, a lot of people laid off from local news. And, you know, we need that local news and community news to keep our democratic dialogue going and to keep people informed.
You say in your piece that you fear the FCC has not done enough to stand up for the public interest.
Right. Well, first of all, the public own the airwaves. There's not a broadcaster in the United States of America that owns an airwave. So they're ours, and broadcasters are the stewards of it. And the law says that broadcasters are given the right to use those airwaves, to be stewards of them for free, and most of them are making a pretty good living off of it. But the quid pro quo for that, what's expected in return, is to serve the public interest, convenience, and necessity. We used to have some guidelines for what that was when you talked about public interest, convenience, and necessity. Were you going out as a broadcaster and talking to members of your community about what kind of issues and programming you wanted? Were you reflecting the community's diversity? Were you doing local sports, local arts, community events, and all that? All of that beginning in the 1980s has been frittered away and whittled away, and now really all a broadcaster has to do to get his license renewed is come in once every 8 years, and unless there's some kind of a character or a charge against him, he's a wife beater or a child abuser or something like that, it's a slam dunk that license is going to be renewed. It used to be, go back 30, 35 years, every 3 years that broadcaster had to come in and demonstrate positively to the commission that he or she was serving the public interest, and we had some guidelines, as I just said, so that we could make a determination. I want to get back to that, and that's what I was writing about in the op-ed piece in the New York Times. This is a precious resource. It's a special industry that people have a right to expect that it's going to be working back toward that localism and diversity that once we had.
I want to get back to this notion of serving the public interest. Does American Idol serve the public interest?
Yeah, I have no problem with shows like that being on the air at all, and there's no place for censorship. But what you have to have is some balance in your programming and some diversity in your programming. So if you had 24 hours of American Idol on a station, no, I don't think that would be serving the public interest.
Well, let me ask you why. Why should there be diversity, and why is it the government's job to tell broadcasters that they have to have a diversity of programming? Do they have to balance American Idol with a show about opera?
There should be diversity because we are a diverse country. There should be diversity because we need to reflect local interests. We need to abide by the law. The law of the land, the Telecommunications Act, says public interest 112 times, I think we counted through it approximately. So Congress is serious about this, and that public interest has historically been defined as localism, diversity, and competition. We have less localism, less diversity, and less competition in the United States media today than we had 15 or 20 years ago.
You write in the piece that one of the questions you'd like to ask is, did the station show programs on local civic affairs apart from the nightly news or set aside airtime for local community groups? I can tell you, Mike, that I have been in the radio business nearly three decades now, and I can remember a time when we did have to put that sort of stuff on. And it always went into what we call the lowest-rated day parts of the week, usually Sunday mornings or late Sunday night, when we knew nobody was listening because those shows don't deliver any kind of audience. In other words, the public doesn't care. And if you're putting those programs on and the public isn't watching or the public isn't listening, are you really serving the interest, or are you just giving them lip service?
I traveled around this country in the last 5 years since Michael Powell tried to further loosen the few remaining constraints that we had on media ownership. I've met with literally thousands of people. Everywhere I go, I sense, and not just sense, I see and hear the tremendous dissatisfaction with the lack of this kind of programming. Let's go back to this diversity thing. In the world that we live in, minorities in this country are over a third of our population right now. Women are 51%. Women, minorities, people of color own in this country very, very few of the media outlets. People of color own approximately 3.26% of full power television stations, and they own not much more. I think the figure that came out today on radio was 7% of radio. Now, what I hear is these people say, why aren't our issues covered on the radio and television? Why are we stereotyped and caricaturized on TV and radio? Why don't we even get the kind of advertising we want, leave alone the programs we want? And it's largely a function, I think, of this consolidation that we have been through and this constant push to serve the bottom line and sell products to that 18 to 34-year-old demographic. And that's fine. I have no problem with that. I got a bunch of those 18, 34-year-olds right in my own family, and I hope they have a lot of good programming to watch. But we're a diverse country with diverse interests, and the media needs to reflect that diversity, and it needs to positively nourish that diversity.
It's News Talk 1120 KMOX. Paul Harris talking with FCC Commissioner Michael Copps about an op-ed piece he wrote this week and other FCC-related issues. I would have no problem if the FCC, if you and the other commissioners said, we need to do a better job regulating who is owning the broadcast outlets in this country so that we open it up so that there's more diversity of ownership. We want to certainly do a good job making sure that the technical side is taken care of so that coverage maps don't overlap in a way that they're not supposed to and stations are broadcasting at the proper wattage and all that sort of stuff. But the hair on the back of my neck stands up every time I hear someone saying that the government should regulate content. And I know there are those in Congress who think this is very important, and I know there are special interest groups in this country who gin up opposition to all sorts of things and can bombard you with emails and faxes telling you that they want this changed and that they represent the American people or whatever it is. But in a country where we have free speech and a free press guaranteed by the Bill of Rights, and a huge variety of media for people to choose from, why should content be your job?
Content is not our job, and we should not be regulating content, but we should be regulating the environment to provide for a diversity of content. We are not getting that diversity of content. We have whole segments of our population who are not being covered. We have others that are being misrepresented. We have a dearth of coverage of local news. You know, We depend in this country, in the democracy that is America, on the American people having the depth and breadth of information that they need to make intelligent decisions. And you give them that breadth and depth, and the premise is they will, by and large, make decisions that are good for the country. But I believe we are skating perilously close, in some significant part because of this consolidation I've talked about, to denying them that opportunity. And I think we all ought to worry about that. And the one resource that we have that is, that can help correct that is the public airwaves. And we need to use them more for that than we are presently using them.
You also say in your op-ed piece in the New York Times this week that one of the criteria which you would like to see them put in place or was put in place in the 90s or considered in the 90s but never actually put in place, that I think in your writing you think that would be a good idea to ask, did the licensee who is asking for renewal, did they broadcast political conventions? Did they broadcast local as well as national candidate debates? Did they devote at least 5 minutes each night to covering politics in the month before an election? You really want to force them to carry political conventions in a day and time when, by the time the convention rolls around, we already know who the nominees of both parties are and it turns into just a four-hour publicity
fest?
I think
there ought to be more of it than there was last time. I think something is wrong when only about 5 or 8% of local TV broadcasts, evening news broadcasts, in the month before the last presidential election contained any coverage whatsoever of local races, and that even includes the House race. I can't remember, and I live in an area that's kind of consumed by politics, seeing really regular broadcasts on my House of Representatives race. That's a pretty important race, and even you turn on the national news on that, and you don't get too much coverage on those individual races like you used to when I was growing up.
But in one breath you say you don't want to regulate content, and in another you're regulating content by saying we want them to do these sort of things.
You're enabling, you're enabling an environment that is hospitable to a range of content. Diversity, diversity, diversity. We're not telling people what to say. We're not telling people at the convention what to say or how to cover that local race or anything like that. But we're saying this is the American people have a right to expect that they will have some access to information like this as they go about their chores of trying to be citizens of the United States of America.
But shouldn't those decisions about what goes into a newscast be made by the people in the newsroom of that broadcast facility?
If they're not providing that, no. I think we have a law of the land and a Communications Act of 1996, going back to 1934, that says the public interest has to be served by the public airwaves, and that's not happening right now all the time. I'm not saying it never happens. I think there's a lot of broadcasters in this country, and I'm sure there's some right out there in St. Louis where the flame of the public interest still burns in their breast, and I have no problem with those folks. But less and less are they captains of their own fate, and more are they captives of this unforgiving expectation of the marketplace and Wall Street and the stock gurus and all of that. And that's not how this industry is supposed to work.
What do you think of those special interest groups who are bombarding you with emails and faxes and letters, usually with just a click of a mouse from one website?
I think the FCC has an obligation to treat all complaints as complaints. I don't think it's our job to go back all the time and trace everyone back to did they send this at the urging of some group or another. I think we're all aware that that those things happen. But I can tell you there's not a day when I go into my office and boot up my computer that I don't see messages that are obviously written from the heart, obviously not written by some kind of organization that says push this button and it goes here.
And what do you say? Do those carry more weight than the ones that do look identical because you get 100 copies of one complaint that look like the same complaint over and over again?
I can't tell you unconsciously or subconsciously. I can't say no, they don't. You shouldn't differentiate because a complaint is a complaint, but we're all human beings and we all see something that's obviously moving. Obviously from the heart, obviously genuine. I think you and I both probably, if we're honest with ourselves, would admit that that probably carries a little more weight. But
Well, here's one thing I know as a broadcaster. People who like your show or like what you're doing write and comment about how much they like it or love it a lot less than people who complain about it. And part of my problem is that we pay much more attention to a small minority of people who may be complaining about something and forgetting about the hundreds of thousands or millions of people who may have enjoyed a broadcast. It's almost as if their vote doesn't count because they didn't write to the FCC and say, by the way, I like that show. Well, and I'm guessing a small minority of your mail that comes to you at the FCC is, hey, that show I heard on KMOX or wherever was terrific. I'm glad it was on the air.
You know, when Michael Powell tried to relax the ownership rules in 2003, we heard from 3 million Americans. When I went to the FCC in 2001, I didn't know there were 3 million Americans that knew that there was a place called the FCC that existed. We heard from 3 million Americans. I've been all around this country, red states, blue states, liberal, conservative, young people, old people. This is a grassroots issue, and I don't think there's any doubt about it. That's why when Powell tried to do that, the Commerce Committee, within 17 days, had reversed what he did, and the full Senate did it twice, and the House was poised to do it, and then the Third Circuit Court sent those rules back to the FCC and said, hey, you got this wrong. So this is, don't mistake this for some little special interest, push the button, 1% of the American people. That's not what this issue is at all, and I think you will see that. We went up to testify before the United States Senate a month or two ago, the first hearing under the new Congress, and we were supposed to be talking about communications competitiveness in the telecom market, telephone industry. Within 5 minutes, they had changed the discussion, the people's representatives, to public interest obligations in the media. And I could go back and look at that record, and you'll find 60-70% of the questions had to do with that. Those people know what's going on across America. They sense the pulse of America, and they know it's a grassroots issue.
Or they're politicians who want more coverage of politics.
Well, even if you want to say they're politicians, politicians react to realities on the ground, and I think a lot of them intellectually share the concerns I've had, but they understand what they see back home when they go to a town hall meeting, where for years and years maybe they never heard much about the media because people didn't have so much to complain about. And now those hands go up and say, hey, what's all this about the FCC trying to loosen those rules? And that's exactly what happened back in 2003.
You talked about the Powell Commission being told by a court that they were wrong. What about the Second Circuit Court yesterday telling you and the rest of the current commission that it was wrong in its rulings on fleeting profanity? What's your reaction to that?
Well, I was disappointed by the decision. It doesn't change the FCC's legal obligation to enforce the statutes that we have, so any broadcaster who sees that as a green light to send more gratuitous sex and violence into our homes would be making, I think, a large mistake. So the FCC has a duty to find a way to breathe life into the laws that protect our kids. I take an oath when I take this job to enforce the statutes, and decency is a statute. So we need to be about the job of enforcing it, and I disagreed with the decision. I didn't think it was, I thought it was a lot of or judicial activism, I guess I would call it, without much deference to expertise of the commission, but I still have deference to the concept of the law, and the law tells me to do my job.
Okay, but if the court just said this yesterday, that's now the law, isn't it? I mean, can you still enforce violations that are fleeting profanity violations?
This is, you know, this, I think we need to revisit a little bit here the fleeting expletive, but there are many cases, complaints before the commission on indecency and profanity, and we have an obligation to enforce those, and I expect that the commission will continue to enforce them. That's our obligation, and this decision does nothing against that.
But I want to clear one thing up. Will you continue to enforce them where it comes to fleeting profanity?
Well, that will depend upon the I would certainly hope that we would find a way to satisfy the court, and in the days ahead, they remanded that rule to us for further consideration and further justification. If we didn't do a good enough job justifying it, I hope we will do a good job justifying it going forward.
All right, Mike, I appreciate
it. Closed.
I'm sorry?
Case is certainly not closed, or the issue is not closed.
But you don't expect it to go to the Supreme Court. This is probably the last time it's going to be heard in court, and that's going to probably have to be the last word, right?
No, I think you're jumping to a conclusion there. It could be appealed to the full circuit court, or it could be appealed to the Supreme Court, and those are all determinations that are yet to be made. This decision is hardly 24 hours old.
Okay. Well, I appreciate your time this afternoon. Thanks for coming on and discussing these issues. I'd like to have you back sometime in the future and have further discussions.
All right. Thank you. Bye.
Thank you very much. Michael Copps, one of the five Federal Communications Commissioners here on the Paul Harris Show on News Talk 1120 KMOX.